Okay, we've started. Sam Pearce, Train of Thought. Hello, how the frig are you doing today?
I'm really well, Ollie. Lovely to be here with you.
Thank you. That's not normally how we start these podcasts. Two big questions coming up. One's a this or that, and okay. The next one is probably a little bit deeper than okay. The first question. My first question, Sam Pearce, dear friend, previous coach of mine. Do I look like a rat or a fish?
Rat or fish? Mm. Rat.
Fucking hell. That's... Thank you for the honesty. Shiny rat. I'm a shiny rat. Okay, cool. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with our traditional question that we ask, but I'm going to ask it, Sam Pearce. Sam Pearce, who was the first person that made you feel like you were talented?
The first person who made me feel talented was my drama teacher.
Oh, yes.
Classic answer for me. I was in year 9 and I had a teacher. His name was Mr. Howells.
Okay.
And I think I'd always felt smart, but I don't think I felt talented. I wasn't very good at sports, which is, I went to an all boys private school, which is how everything is measured. And I started acting and he just made me feel like I could do it. He made me feel talented. It was an incredible gift that he gave. He taught us English as well. And he just taught us so much about the world. It was quite an unusual approach to teaching, but I remember more of his lessons than anyone else. But he made me feel like I could do something. And he also, really importantly, made it feel like that was in me, that it was something worth cherishing and fighting for. And I haven't thought about that in years. So it's a great question.
Was that confidence or like, is that knowing, is that somebody saying to you, you can, or forget you can, you're doing it? What was the kind of...
I think it was that because I wasn't good at sport, and that was such a high barometer, I think I felt a bit aimless with what I was about.
Right.
Okay. Something that was mine and felt real. So whilst I think I was academically fine, neither was I like, I wasn't that bothered about that. Yeah. That was not an enormous thing for me. As some people like obviously get a lot out of being really clever. And I wasn't like abnormally clever. I did well. But suddenly there was this thing that I enjoyed doing and was encouraged to do. And someone said, you're good at. And suddenly I was like, there's this thing that's mine and it feels like it lives inside me and I can do this in my own time, you know. And I think he saw something that I cared about. And it gave me something. I think I was very insecure, and it gave me something that just allowed me to build my confidence around.
That's a really interesting answer. I think it's funny, people go to their career a lot of the time with that question. Some have gone all the way to birth. And hopefully that's not going to get picked up. I'm going to carry on. We're going to have to, otherwise it's going to be a very jerky podcast. So, okay, cool. I'm going to describe you as to how I see you and maybe how the reader or the listener is going to see you if they would type your name into LinkedIn. So Sam Pearce loves improv acting, has been talented at acting for a long time, then gets a job in advertising as a suit or an account person or client service person. Worked at formidable businesses like Adam and Eve and Havas. Then boom, he leaves. He becomes a coach that I have used. We'll come on to that later. Can you take me on that journey in 90 seconds? What happened there?
I was the account guy that annoyed everyone with being super ambitious. I assume I must have been very annoying to work with. I found advertising and I fell into it and thought, I just want this to be my life. And then I burnt out is the short answer. I was spending more and more hours doing less and less. I didn't know who I was in my 20s. And this advertising is a great vehicle for that because there's no limits, there's no boundaries. You can just keep pouring yourself in. So enormously ambitious, worked very hard, but didn't have enough security, self-awareness, confidence in myself to set limits for myself. So I burnt out. And when I burnt out, I realized that I wasn't as interested in advertising as I thought. That was a big thing. Secondly, I realized that I wanted more for myself, physically, mentally, personally. Thirdly, I met my wife, who was my client, and that changed a lot. Suddenly, there was someone I wanted to be home for in the evening, as opposed to thinking I stay in the office because I get a free meal.
Worth noting, you were that good at client services.
You can take it too far. You can take it way too far. and then after that was, I saw a load of problems and I wanted to solve them. And I knew because of the previous three things, I knew that I didn't have it in me to solve it from within. I knew that I couldn't put up with the challenges and hold on to this stuff that I'd found through burning out. I'd found this a load of philosophy and different ways of thinking about the world and myself. And I didn't feel that I wanted to or had what it takes to put up the battle from fixing it within, whilst also making this my life and changing those ways I lived, really.
Yeah. So just like to tell a linear story, I'm going to use the term codependent. It's a term that I would definitely use on myself. I can be codependent. So as somebody that is just an overachiever, wanting to impress anybody in the guise of advertising, with that, you can just show them in hours. You can show them in just constantly being available. And if you tell your client services director or managing director or CEO that you're the person that they can rely on no matter what, because you just want them to love you, that's the drug that you got addicted to, right?
100%.
And so you lost your boundaries that you would have been putting in place had you been more self-aware at that time, and had you have known why you were doing that job. And you that ended up getting you to a point of your brain working harder than your body could go. And then you grinding to a classic halt, and the cliche as it sounds, you reach the burnout point, which is used a lot, but I feel what you mean by burnout, because you've gone from hyper overachiever to what do I do next? Tell me about how you knew you had burnout and how you knew that was as a result of working your ass off too hard.
The best description I can have of it all started to feel so thin.
Right.
I was working these I was working 90 hour weeks. At the time I was paid like 32 grand or something, you know, per hour I earned less than working in a supermarket. And everything felt so thin. The achievements didn't feel big. I didn't feel good about myself. I didn't feel like I was moving the dial. I felt like I was doing nonsense, really. And what happened was it wasn't sudden or dramatic, this decline in just satisfaction with life, satisfaction in myself, and just this, I couldn't stop. And I think that's the biggest sign of the burnout, is that you just, this disbelief that you can stop. And I've seen so many other people go through it. I've gone through it myself. And it's devastating. It's devastating. And you do hit rock bottom, because I think to a certain extent, it is just an addiction like any other. It's just the substance is your own adrenaline and your own cortisol rather than something you're putting into your body. But that, I just wasn't happy. And I felt really hopeless. I remember really thinking I had no options. Like I remember walking out of one of the agencies with my wife and her saying, you know, you can do other things, right? And my answer to her was, no, I can't. This is all I know. This is all I can do. This is all I'm good for. And that's not true for anyone.
No.
Ever.
No.
And I was 27. Yeah. I was 27 years old. It's very depressing to hear, think in hindsight.
There's two things happening here, right? Because somebody could go, the role of an account person is a really bad role, you shouldn't do it, it's stressful, and blame it on the external factors that you cannot control. Or there's the other question, which is the boundaries I'm putting in place and my recognition of who I am and the part I play in this role and whether it's right for me is on me. And it's not on the agency or brand or whatever that has hired me to do those things, because at the end of the day, it was my choice to say I was hyper available. It was my choice to be very good at this thing. And I played the game to the beat of their drum. So what had to happen there? Actually, before I ask you that question, can you describe, that's an unhappy client services person that's very good at their job. Can you describe anyone that you know that's a happy client services person that is good at their job and doesn't feel like that?
Yeah, the happy client services person is just all about relationships. It's being able to read people, what they want, what they need, and being able to solve the problem so they get it and everyone wins. And it's really interesting what you mentioned about like the personal responsibility and accountability part as opposed to the context. And you've almost certainly heard me talk about this before, but I'm a huge embracer of paradoxes. Two things that are seemingly contrary can be true at the same time. And Western thought doesn't deal well with paradoxes, because Aristotle's logic was things are or they aren't. So in that case, it's either your fault or it's the industry's, right? You have to pick one. And I'm a huge, in all my work, I'm like, that's nonsense. You don't have to pick one. Both are true. And the contexts in which we work have got harder and harder to have boundaries in. And our lack of boundaries is making the context worse. So you've kind of got this spiral. But I think the it's very, very possible to have enormously incredible careers in this industry. But it goes back to, and I know we've talked about it so much, it depends what you're doing. It depends what the objective is. It depends what is important, what we see the jobs as. And so, yeah, I think someone, client services at its best was awesome. It was amazing at its best. I loved it. But there wasn't enough of that by the time I left. And I didn't have what it takes, which I think can often now be a huge amount of security. I can think of someone I worked with who had it in spades and could make that job amazing. That person was exceptional. They were incredible. And they were able to navigate this world without losing themselves. But those are skills that aren't necessarily taught. That resilience, that which is a word which I have a difficult relationship with. It's often
a paradoxical.
Very. It's often very badly used. But at its best, it's an incredible job, amazing job. Oh God, at its best, I loved it, absolutely loved it.
But you left it.
Yes.
And then you became a coach.
Yes.
So talk to me about this. What would I understand? It's not. I mean this in a nice way, it's not a unit, you're not the only person I know that has left a role and then become a coach.
Yeah.
It's quite traditional that the people find that path through reaching burnout with their previous career. What I like is that you're now coaching those people that, you know, were like you. What kind of shortcuts or what is your approach? Okay, actually no, talk to me about the person that is an ideal client, right? Mm-hmm. And what kind of journey do you take that person on?
The work I do and my expertise is the thing I'm really interested in is on the most fundamental, deepest level. What does this person think things are? And this can sound very intangible. In some ways it is. But what is your job? What is advertising? What is client services? Because these questions that no one ever asks and people are very afraid of going into because they're worried that they don't have answers very often affects everything you do. If whatever you, and we're going to talk about CEO-dom for you shortly, but whatever you think a CEO is, what you think their behaviors are, how you think they act, how you think they speak, what you think they do, will affect how you show up in that every single day. And so these narratives that live in our heads, these ideas about the world, philosophies, thoughts, influence everything we do.
That's really interesting.
But we don't often interrogate them. We just assume stuff. So if I say the word CEO to you and you will have assumption on what that means.
Yeah.
You may never have thought about it. I had a client recently who had a one-year-old and he was like, I'm not showing up in my work or as a father how I want to. And I was like, what's fatherhood mean to you? Mm. And he just sat in silence for minutes and we went, I've never thought of that. He has a one-year-old. And he said, how have I got here? And I was like, I don't know. But
it's so easy though.
It's so easy. You just have a kid.
It happens in everything. What is a good, what is a best friend? And what I love about what you're saying is that you can polarize all of these, like you can become in a bad relationship with that archetype that you're playing with that person, right?
Absolutely. So
bad best friend is when you start to self-sabotage to, you know, fit their needs.
Yeah.
Bad employee or bad account director is the person that self-sabotages to fit the person above them's need and they should have spoken up. Bad CEO in my eyes, we'll come onto that. But like, these things that you're speaking about, you don't address them. You just play in the position that you think you're going to be in. And actually, almost more dangerously, I feel like you play in the position of fear and your insecurities.
Yes.
When we speak about the criteria that I set myself to become a CEO, in somebody else's eyes that has my opposite skill set, they think I'm a CEO. But in my eyes, I'm not. Because of the things I'm really insecure about, numbers, systems, you know, understanding the direction of the company, where we're going and having ultimate clarity. Though, because of my insecurities of the idea of what a CEO is, that then has an impact on me because I've never until recently clearly defined what that thing is. So that's step one in your process, is getting them to understand where they are and what the job that they do or find important is.
Yeah.
Right. So you get the metric. Is it metrics? How do you like, what do you want out of that question?
So I think I can break down, I can break down broadly into four things what I think my job is. I'm a champion, a sounding board, a conscience, and the person who calls people on their bullshit. Okay. And at its purest, I'm those four things. And so the first thing is to understand how they currently think. So when you say CEO, what do you mean? And through that, I then can find the gap between where they want to go and where they are. Because they will tell me, they'll usually tell me what do you want is actually the real first step. Like, where do you want to go? What do you want? So that's often like CEO. And they'll say, what is CEO to you? And they will tell me what CEO is. And we identify a gap. Maybe fear, insecurity, all sorts of things. And obviously this works in different ways for different people with different clients. And then it's about finding stories, metaphors, tools of the mind. We are storytelling creative creatures that get them from one to the other, from a belief standpoint. So understanding, seeing the world differently. And I have a couple of skills that make me very good at that. One is I have a very strong associative brain. It's why I do improv. I can make connections very, very quickly.
Yeah, you'll use an example or a metaphor. You're very good. I've noticed that.
So that for me happens very, very quickly. And it's a skill I've... guess nurtured without really meaning to, but also I guess a skill I have. So I can connect dots very quickly, and I'm very good at communicating those in a way that is accessible to people. And then when you shift that belief, so you start to change how someone thinks about something, how someone sees something, then essentially you get to change their behavior.
Right.
So they've got to do something. And all we really are is beliefs and actions. And so we have beliefs about ourselves, and they lead us to take actions. And those actions reinforce the beliefs. So you can get people into this kind of circle of change where you interrogate something that is challenging them. You find out what's actually going on below the surface. So I coach at the deepest possible level I can find, the deepest insecurity, the deepest like thing you're seeing that gets in the way.
What's an example of that?
What's a good example that's appropriate?
Like a deep... We could do me if you want.
Okay.
That's maybe a good one. I mean, that's where we met, right?
Yeah.
I remember...
That's a great example.
We'll just pivot for a bit of story time here, because that's probably maybe a good example. Oh my God, this is actually quite a funny story. I've told this on so many podcasts, but this one is interesting. I'll do a quick version. I went to a presentation course, and I did it because I had a fear of public speaking. It was a lady that looked like Edna Mode. I always
Tish, yeah.
Tish, yeah, yeah. Tish Mouse, now capes, that lady. And we went on it, and there was all these scary people. I thought it was to get rid of my anxiety of public speaking. It was the opposite. It was comedians and people that were just very able to public speak. And I ended up doing my thing, and she said to me at the end of the day, that was, you're the first person I've ever done or coached where the presentation at the beginning of the day was better than the one at the end. Right, so I just I completely flopped. I cried in the toilets afterwards. Oh, I remember calling I had a life coach at that time. I was very confused as a person. And then she sent me this lovely email afterwards. Like, it was kind of cute, but patronizing at the same time. It was like, oh, Lee, no. Yeah, I wouldn't say come back. I'd say there's another person that you should meet who's called Sam, and he specializes in helping people get to a deeper rooted problem. You know, when you were so scared and short of breath and showing all the signs of someone that was very anxious about being up in front of and speaking to people, you were showing me signs that things that I couldn't help. So then she referred me on to you. I went and sat in your lovely living room in, at that time, East London. And I remember we sat down, right? It's funny, because even talking about it now gives me a little bit of anxiety, because I was so lost. I was that desperate, no offense, to go to a random man's living room in East London and then go, can you solve this thing in my head? Because it's not my mouth. It's not how I speak or, you know, what I think. It's just getting me to feel comfortable in doing that. So me and you got into that pretty quick, right?
Yeah, we solved it in 2 hours.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
It was weird. After meeting, I can't remember what you said. It was a blur, if I'm honest.
Before this podcast, I spent a long time thinking, I think I can remember it.
You do this, because I was like, whatever, man.
So if we go into like what the thing was. So you thought you had a fear of public speaking. That wasn't the problem. The problem was... you felt like a fraud beneath unknown. Yes. So you would essentially have a panic attack when you spoke about unknown.
Oh, yeah.
And so when we got into the root of that, you didn't feel, if I remember this correctly, so I'll do my best job, but you didn't feel like you deserved, should, were the right person, had enough experience, all of the insecurities. And so you were trying to talk about this externality, unknown.
Yes.
And every time you did so, you felt so far away from it, you'd have a panic attack.
Yeah.
Does that
really resonates. I remember being like, I would do weird things, like on the train home from work or on the walk from the station to my home, I would film myself pitching unknown, right? And I knew I looked weird. I was walking like next to busy traffic being like, okay, it's not who you know, it's who you don't. And like, I remember just being like, what the hell am I doing, man? I'd send myself voice notes and I thought it was the script. And again, like you're saying, it was all these externalities. It was like, well, maybe the words aren't right.
Yeah.
Maybe the idea isn't right. And I'd say those things to you and you were like, no, the words are great.
Yeah,
the idea is really strong. I work in this industry. I love the proposition of the recruitment company you're talking about.
Yeah.
But you don't think you're right for this thing.
Yes.
And you were the first person to say that to me. And actually the first person I felt like I was allowed to say that to and admit that to.
Yeah, and the fix was, I just told you to stop talking about unknown and just give Ollie's opinion. That was the solution. It was like, I just want you, Ollie, to tell me about what you think is wrong with the recruitment industry. Yeah. I just want to tell people what you think is wrong. I want you to tell you what you think is the right answer.
Yeah.
And like, when we removed the artifice of unknown, which had become like, this happens a lot with a lot of business owners and leaders, which is if I can fix that thing over there, then it will hide and mask my insecurities. I'll feel strong in it. And of course, it doesn't work that way. When you came into my living room, I remember you came in, you kicked your shoes off and you sat cross-legged on this window bench I had. And I was like, I cannot understand how this guy is having a problem. Like, he came in with so much confidence and so much charisma and charm. And you were so, like, from the first moment, I was like, this guy is fine.
Yeah.
Like, he's going to be fine.
Wait till he pitches.
Yeah, yeah. But it was seeing that you were trying to hide behind the company. That was the thing. So you were trying to make the business do the work when you were the business. Like, so clearly what you believed in it so fully. And there are some certain ways you tell monologues in improv, which is some of the theory that I used in that moment. But it's like, it's just easier to say I.
Yeah.
It's much easier to say, you know what? I've had this experience. I've met these people. This isn't working.
Yeah.
And so here's what I'm going to do differently. So we just had to drop unknown. Unknown became the secondary thing behind you.
Yeah.
For that first starting of the first part of your company. And it was just Ollie going out being Ollie.
Yeah.
And of course, you absolutely nailed it.
That was, but you've reminded me, that was the thing. I remember the pitch changed. It used to be, I used to say unknown is this thing because it spotted that. And I'd feel weird saying that. Like it was a living being, this fucking domain.
unknown.io.
This little URL is going, I don't like the industry. So that felt weird. And you're right. It was an amazing pivot. So like, just to cover that off, thank you again.
Absolutely.
So getting me out of that funk. It was a long old fucking tearful funk. But B, like, it's really clear to me personally, hey, here we are, I experienced the power of what you do. Tell me more. So like, I remember you saying the line to me about what train of thought was, and this must be so hard because you're speaking to people that come up with lines every day.
Yes, yeah.
So, and you're trying to distinguish yourself as a coach.
Yeah. And I worked in the environments where we come up with lines. So that like the knowledge of marketing is both a real blessing and an absolute curse.
Yeah.
When you run your own business, because you get lost in trying to come up with really smart lines, which doesn't really matter to an executive coach. Like, it just doesn't.
They are, the more wanky they sound.
Yeah, and they become the same thing you had, which I've had, which is like, they get in the way.
Yes.
Of me as the individual, which is really what I'm selling. So yeah, the advertising thing is both a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
When you move out. Take me where the thing's gone from and to, or where you've gone from and to, whichever one you feel more comfortable.
So at the very start, the thing I was really interested in, that what I was fascinated by, and I'm still fascinated by, it's just not the whole ball game anymore. I was fascinated by this burnout experience had happened to me. And it had made me just worse at my job. And that fascinated me. Because I looked around, and I was like, everyone else is in it. Everyone else is as stressed, they're as busy as I am. This doesn't make any sense. And the work is getting worse and everyone's getting iller. No one's loving this, but clearly we've lost the plot somehow. So that was my initial thing. My very start was astonishingly naive. I mean, now I probably wouldn't take the leap with what I had, but I thought, I was like, improv skills can help this. So so initially it was... I was surviving in these environments through my improv skills and doing and was in a better shape than most people were. This is kind of after the burnout in that period where and to a certain extent, I've been like, this doesn't really matter to me anymore, which made it all a lot easier.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of wisdom in that for everyone. But I was using these skills to navigate these incredibly toxic environments I was in. So initially, that was what I wanted to do. And where it pivoted was, firstly, I met a mentor, really, a guy named John. My final day at Adam and Eve, I was having a conversation with an animator. He was like, oh, my cousin does something like this. And it was a guy named John who started coaching me and then became a mentor. And he opened the door, really, to this very different profession, which I hadn't really thought of when I started my business. And it was just after going through that and being mentored by him, and it was like a duck to water. Suddenly I found this thing. And I just love being in front of a person and just watching them transform and change. And I'm very good at it. And the merging of like the enjoyment of it and being very good at it. And there's so much philosophy in it. There's so much about how people think and psychology. But also watching people change stuff. It's very tangible. I like the experience of watching someone in front of me come back into a session and be like, I've done X, Y, Z. It's changed everything. It's an enormous, and it's one of the few jobs where you have regularly people say to you, you've changed my life.
Yeah.
Like, I can't think of anything better. And the other side of it, which I'm also really open about, is I have a 10-month-old, as you know, who has currently got a cold after being at nursery for one day. But I knew I wanted children, and I knew I wanted to be around a lot. I did not want to be an hour in evenings at bath time. Mm. And I wanted to spend half my time with her was what I wanted. And I've made that happen. And so there was also wanting to run my own business, control my own hours. I've spent more time with my daughter than most fathers get in years. Yeah. And I'm enormously grateful for that. Not every day.
Yeah.
Some days, the cold days.
Not last night.
But that was also a huge priority for me, was a big believer in us just achieving more in less time.
Yeah.
So what I really do now is I just help people change. I help people transform. And I work with leaders, C-suites, you know, business owners, founders, and I just help them just evolve into much more powerful versions of themselves and just pull the stuff out of the way. Mm. So that's the kind of journey and the pivot. And I still love doing the workshops back in with the improv skills. Like, I still do that part of it. I'm still a speaker and a huge advocate. My main talk I do most frequently is called Busy Isn't Working. Mm. And that's about the working cultures we've built ourselves into are just nonsensical, really nonsensical. So that's the kind of journey I went on into becoming. And I guess from my experience, just coaching more and more senior levels just comes with the skills and the experience being developed.
Yeah. So ideal client, what would they look like? Define them.
The ideal client, I mean, is just someone, firstly, it's someone who is just really, really hungry. Like hungry for something, hungry for change, hungry to be better. That hunger, like...
So drive is key.
Drive is really key. And what's interesting is drive can sometimes be fear and insecurity.
Yeah.
So the two are mirrors, really, of one another. So sometimes it's people who come to you at a very low ebb, which was obviously where you came in, but that was a mirror to your ambition. And so it doesn't always manifest as, it doesn't always manifest immediately as drive, but it is under the surface.
I've got a question on this, man, and this is a hard one to answer. I don't think anyone's managed to do this succinctly, but we'll give it a try. What if your biggest drive is your insecurity and anxiety, but you are highly successful? And when you start going around sniffing around my business and I'm going, whoa, don't look at that thing. That's my thing that keeps me going. It's my fear that my dad doesn't love me and he's dead, so that's never gonna change. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, I'm holding on to be my fuel, mm-hmm. right, that I burn. What do you do in that situation?
So firstly, I love use the word fuel. It's one of my favorite metaphors that I came up with around this, which is all of us have a fuel to propel ourselves through life. And the metaphor is very apt for the climate crisis we find ourselves in. That the cleanliness of the fuel determines the fumes and the condition of the engine. So most of us learn to propel ourselves through life through insecurity, through fearing failure, trying to please our parents, like all that kind of stuff. And that's fine, but that's like fossil fuels. It produces a smog, dirties the engine. And so you can continue for the rest of your life to drive yourself through that and you will feel the cost. Whereas what are green renewable fuels in this sense? Love, compassion, fulfillment, meaning. They're all fuels. It's actually less about right and wrong, good and bad than people think. Mm. Just there's consequences. So the thing my coachy head, when you said, are they really successful? I'd be successful at what? Successful at what? By what measure? Mm. Because you're going to spend a really hard time convincing me like Elon Musk is a happy guy. Like And I don't know, maybe he is. Maybe that's my judgment. Mm. But successful at what? So we live in a society that venerates achievement, particularly around career, particularly around finances. But if that's not what you want, really, under the surface. So that example of like, I drive myself in through insecurity. Mm. I wanted to appeal, like the father, what we want there is love. Like that's what we're looking for. We want love and we find it through this workplace. And so in that instance, it's about some helping someone see that with compassion, no judgment. And they may need to go through healing, and therapy is an amazing tool for that kind of thing. But in that instance, let's reset what success is. Let's really focus in on what you actually want. Mm. And how can we redefine in your head what success is? Because when I have challenges in my business, I compare myself to other coaches I know, and I know how much they're earning. I know how much my coach earns and all that kind of stuff. And then I think about how much time I spend with my daughter, and how much time I spend with my wife, and how little I commute. And that's a yardstick for me. And would I earn half as much to have the lifestyle I had? Yeah, hands down. Like it's not even a question. But I default, even though I think about this all the time, I default to the conventional measure of money.
Yeah.
Successful at what? What does success mean to you? What would you love? Mm. That's where we start to unpick the stuff that's actually going on below the surface.
It's really, and we've done back and forth voice notes about this, and I'm happy to speak about the CEO thing now, because I had this, obviously, as you know, I never called myself CEO from the beginning, right? And called myself founder. The main reason was because I saw so many people that were like one man bands being like CEO, and I'm like, no. And I didn't want to be that guy. And being very honest, you met me at that time, I was incredibly like impostery or whatever.
Yeah.
So as it went on, you know, we grew from 0 to 5, 5 to 10, 10 to 17, you know, whatever. There wasn't ever a moment where I was like, I'm CEO now. You know, I didn't feel like I had to suddenly appoint myself. Then something changed in the business. It didn't actually. What changed was my perception of the business. I think we'd hit a load of invisible milestones that I was really proud of.
Mm.
And I began stagnating a little bit
in
this comfort, because I built what I wanted to in its purest sense of people that feel comfortable, people that are being, you know, given a platform to change their lives and hopefully change the industry and feel good for doing that in the right way. And I wanted it to be kind of hippie in a weird way. Like it's a strange thing that we talk about, which is like high performing, high earning, but also happy at the same time, right? Yeah. And so that's been the journey was to do that. Then we hit this point of, you know, 15 people, and I was like, are they high performing? Are they high earning? Are they happy? And then I was like, do you know what's happened? I have become complacent, actually. And I'm sort of not really giving clear directions, destinations to these people, because I'm not being a CEO. Mm. I'm being the founder that hangs around, has a fun time with everybody and goes, isn't this a laugh? It's not a laugh. Oh, right. Well, maybe you should leave. You know, it got to a point of, I would say, like reduction, actually.
Yeah.
And I looked at myself and I thought, right, what do I need to do then? How do I need to show up to this business? What do I want it to become? And I tried my absolute hardest to not just put nebulous figures, like we're going to be this number. You have to do something, like you have to say we're going to be this many, many millions, because it is helpful to measure.
Yes, of course.
But the secondary point to that was, I want them to be high earning, high performing, and happy, because that's the thing. If other people are doing that, then I'm going to feel good. And I think, yeah, you're right. If I was given a chance to be running a £100 million business versus, you know, of relatively unhappy people, and I didn't know everybody's name, versus running a £10 million business where I knew everyone's names, I knew that the impact this business was having on their lives was a good one, which one would I feel happier and better with?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it's like to have £100 million. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's like to have £10 million.
But I'm not sure it's that different.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that different.
It's just numeric, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get in, you know, I listen to so many of these conversations and podcasts about, it's always a rich person saying like the money doesn't change you.
Yeah.
And, you know, fair enough, because they've got the money and you don't.
Yeah.
But you want to kind of go, well, okay, let me just try and get rich first, and then I can make that call myself.
Yeah.
At what expense? So I had to set myself some objectives to become CEO. I set myself like 3 objectives, basically. And those 3 objectives were hard goals to hit. They were about the people. One was very much around nourishing their brains. And we had a whole bunch of things in there. Today was the day that I sat down with my head of people and said, okay, how did I do? Did I get to CEO? And we were really honest, right? We looked at the OKRs, you know, impacting briefs, And she was like, how do you feel? I was like, yeah, I think like 85%. I think like I've done enough this quarter. And she, fair enough to her. She was like, enough. I was like, yeah. And she went, go on, enough. Bearing in mind that we just did five back-to-back reviews of everybody. And the line I kept on saying is, we're going to abolish mediocrity. No more mediocrity. I can't do it. I don't like it. I don't like having people in my company that are mediocre. Nobody likes being around those people, right? Particularly when you're small. So she was like, so considering that you're saying abolishing mediocrity and you're 85% of hitting your OKRs, are you going to promote yourself? I was like, well, no, not now you said that. That wasn't how this is meant to go. But I like that. I've gone on a bit of a tangent here, but like, I like that. That to me is me going, yeah. And do you know what's funny? I put votes out to the business saying, have I impacted the amount of briefs to you, not to the business, to you as the employee of this business? Do you have a clear vision on where the business is going and the impact that you're going to play in that? And I sent another question, which I can't remember verbatim. And it was interesting. It was yes, no, or not sure. It was about 80% yes. There were no, there was strong no's in there. There's a whole division that said no to me impacting their briefs. And I was like, that's a failing. That, like, that's mediocre from me. I should have known that that was going to happen. I wouldn't have asked that question. But that is a failing. So it's weird. I wasn't expecting to come on here today with you and say, I'm not going to call myself CEO yet. But we've sat down, we've addressed it, and I'm really clear that actually I showed up to be about 85% of the person that I should and could have been this quarter.
I think the first, like the first thing hearing you say that is like just your openness and cred. Like, yeah, I feel the same I felt when I saw you in my living room, and I was like, this guy's. I just love, you know, I love so many things about the way you do what you do.
Thanks, man.
I think like I want to shine a spotlight on some of the like shame in there that I should.
Yeah.
Like I think it's really important to note that, because I think that. That expectation, there is no should. Should is a shaming word. Like these bars we set for ourselves, these externalities of what a CEO does, they're not true. The only bars that actually matter are the ones you care about.
Yeah.
So if you've not hit the targets you set for yourself, like that's okay. That happens. But it's really important to like to see the shame of like, I should have like done X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
You could have, and you can. I just wanted to note that too. But it's really, it's such an interesting process you've chosen. Like for you, what you say 85%, you've got these 15%, use the word mediocrity. Like what is the 15%? And the thing I want you to encourage you to think about here, and this is, we had a conversation about 18 months ago and we had a Zoom call. And I think it was probably you at the start of the journey you've just gone on. Because I remember the conversation we're having now feels like literally a carry on from that. And I remember saying to you on that call something like, this is about who you want to be.
Yeah.
And I think CEO more than any other role in a business is about who you are. It's about, and I mean the man, the woman, the, you know, the person that sits underneath this. Yeah. So this 15%, if you think about it not in business speak, but if you speak about it as Ollie, This person sat in front of me now, like this wonderful person sat in front of me now. What's the 15% gap?
I had the business answer nailed ready.
And yeah, good I to thought go. You would.
And I was really proud of it.
Yeah, and you can share that too. But I want to hear the Ollie the man.
Okay, answer. Well, yeah, the business answer is actually the business answer, because it will help me get into the man thing or who I am, is that I've worked so hard on systems and stuff. I still don't believe myself when I'm saying that I'm going to do something. And I feel so in the moment when I set myself targets that they're nothing. They mean nothing. Like when you write New Year's resolutions. And I know the ones I set myself last quarter, I cared about 70%. And I know I went on a business course, and the growth plan that I came out with at the back of that, I'm like 70% committed to. I want to stop doing that. And I don't like how that can drip into my leadership and personal life, saying I'm going to do something kind of committing 70% to it and they're not, leaving this kind of room for potential failure to make myself feel better because I didn't really care about it in the first place. I want to stop doing that. So I think to get really deep really quick, I want to be able to take myself seriously and be really committed to the goals that I'm setting myself and not set nebulous goals that don't mean anything, because I know I can be like, ah, well, things change. Because that's a really easy out. And the goals I've always set myself are, I'll do that next time. So the man that I want to become before I enter things like CEO-manship, fatherhood, everything that takes responsibility, I kind of want to trust my word. And I kind of don't want to give myself an out. And I kind of want to hold myself accountable to something, because it's really easy to not. That's such an easy thing for me to do. And it's a place of comfort. I can show to the world that I'm, you know, doing all these really hard and hard to achieve things by, you know, setting medium to hard things. But what if I set something that I really cared about? And so that, does that answer your question?
It does. You said the word I was hoping you would say. It was commitment.
Commitment.
That was the word. If you hadn't said it, I would have.
Okay.
And commitment is essentially an all-inness.
Mm.
And what's so interesting, and we all do this, like I've done it in my business where I've had contracts where that have provided security, and so I have not done the things I wanted to do. I wanted to grow and spend, you know, I wanted to grow to a certain level or whatever, and I've not done them because the security of over here. And I think with someone as, you're so charming, you're so personable, you really are, there is a downside to that, which is that you can charm your way out of things as well.
Oh yeah.
And there's Ollie and then there's a character Ollie. We all have that, right? There's Sam and there's the character Sam. Mm. And actually the next stage of the evolution that I see for you is actually to spend less time in the character, to actually let that go and stand much more firmly in Ollie. And because the reason for that is, like, when we drop the mask, we are much more all in. Like that all inness, the sacrifice of safety, the security. And we all weave characters, personalities around ourselves. Like when we're teenagers, that's how we survive school, is to create these characters for ourselves. When you begin to drop it, and what's really interesting for me is just having gone through the first year of fatherhood, like the character is borderline meaningless for a huge amount of it. My daughter doesn't care, like, as much as, so, but I think it's, when I think about fatherhood, and there's an archetype for it, which is the king, the decisions the king makes, how he looks to the kingdom rather than to himself. And it seems, my interpretation of that is the phase you're in, which at some point, some of the things that have made you successful, some of the things that you rely on to get through your day to day to be successful, they're like a snake's skin. They have to be shed.
Yeah.
Some of the behaviors, some of the ways you think, some of the ways you've got out of problems, some of the ways you've circumvented problems and like found it out. They're gonna have to go, because they ultimately undermine something that is more important to you in the long term.
Yeah.
And so some of your behaviors, and this is, of course, you know, this is what I do, but some of the behaviors need to come to a spotlight. And the way you're not, like, I mean, if we were sat in a coaching session, I'd be like, my questions would be essentially, what makes you duck out? How do we shine a light on it? And how do we change it? Mm-hmm. Because your full heart and soul into it is how you reach your potential, as everyone does.
I love that. Wow, that was good. That was a nice little moment there. I realize we are speeding on through this, and I've not even asked you. We're going to have to miss a whole section out here, which is nobody wants to work for you.
Yeah, yeah. We'll come back and do that a second time, because I think that is well worth
it. That's a whole podcast in itself, and we'll have to have a conversation and debrief on that. I feel like you may have read the Stinky Fish thing and brought something along.
So I had to ask my wife.
Okay,
she bears the brunt of the things that frustrate me. And I am going to admit that I'm someone who gets very, very annoyed by small things.
Fantastic. You are ideal for this part of the
section. She gave me a list. So one thing that really annoys me is just technology not doing what it says it's going to do. I'm just going to reel through a couple of them. Fine. She said, I'm really annoyed by small dogs, which I didn't know.
Fucking hell.
Which I didn't know.
The devil.
Which apparently, there was a small dog on the train platform.
Past and go, oh, get a
just,
boot.
They're just not as good as big dogs. I mean, let's call a spade a spade. Wow. That'll make some people furious. But I have one because it happened recently about something that really annoys me. we were in, I can't remember, Coco Populaire or whatever, the
Italian, nice.
And they bring over some water. That's a lovely thing to do, bring over a bottle of water. And I get the bill, and it says £1 water.
Ooh.
And this is a huge bugbear of mine. Because if you're going to charge for something, tell me at the time.
Assumption bias.
Yeah, if that's how you do your water and how you make filter and all that kind of stuff, I have no problem. Just put the water down and be like, you know, this is a pound. And then it compounded with me having to pay the bill on a QR code, which I don't really like. I'd much rather pay the bill. Part of the reason being the service, quite frankly, wasn't very good. And I probably would have said, I'm not paying the service charge, but you had to, it said on there, you have to tell them. Then that's how they encourage you to pay. And it cost me 90p for that transaction.
Oh, so you get charged with the privilege of paying on the little fancy QR code.
Yeah, so £1.89 they made from me, and they have a quartered my chance of ever going back. Because it bugs me that much.
I think I know some people out there that are like you. I could not be further from that. But I'm the sort of person that apologizes for somebody's bad service. Like, it's in, like, I would be like, oh, bless them. We should give them a tip because they're so shit. And I'm sure nobody else gives them a tip. Dumb. It's a weird way of thinking.
It's much kinder than mine. Which
it's not kind. It's probably just a bit lame, actually. Like, making excuses for someone who's not very good at their job. But yeah, man, I can relate to that.
It really, and do you know who does it so well? Is Dishoom. They use the same app service, and I went to Dishoom the day after.
You love Dishoom.
I love Dishoom. It's my favorite.
Smells good as well. My favorite restaurant. Curry. It smells like incense.
It smells amazing. Full disclosure: my wife did used to work in their marketing head office, but it was. I love it. It's always great. The service is phenomenal. And like, so they do the app thing, but you don't have to pay the 90p. And I'm like, oh, 90p you've paid, but you've made me. Oh, they're so generous.
Yeah, yeah.
They're so generous.
And by comparison, whereas Big Mama Group, you're like, nah.
Exactly. You've stung me for that. So, I mean, honestly, we could fill several hours with all the small, tiny things that annoy me. Big things don't tend to annoy me that much. Small things. Absolutely drive me nuts.
Yeah, I don't see you getting annoyed about like, oh, what's Trump done this week? He's not even president anymore. But like, I can't imagine you kind of going...
I'm more like, I analyse that, but it's the little things. It's like, so we have Nest thermostats in our house. Loathe them. I hate them so much. They do not put technology between me and my hot water. That's what I'm saying. They never work. I will stop there because I could talk about Nest thermostats for hours.
That's fine. Okay, well, look, we've got 1 minute left. So I'm going to say... is there anything that you wanted to cover off before I say thank you so much, Sam Pierce, for being here? Any questions you'd like to ask? It's your stage. Sister.
I think the main thing I want to say is just, I know I've praised you several points for this. I've meant every single one. Like the way you approach your business and approach yourself and approach the industry, I find such an enormous, like, I'm just such a champion for you doing it because there's some conversations you've started and you're having that's so desperately required. And there's few people better placed, but... the way, and I think this is so interesting in the wake of you obviously not going all in with everything, but the way in which you just leap into them and are a champion for people, it's just wonderful. And it's so, so needed. So thank you for doing it.
Thank you, man. I'm never going to be okay accepting compliment. I fucking hate compliment. No offense. Mm-hmm. I would love it if you'd be like, tell me why you're so, like, you know. You suck.
Yeah,
like,
we'll work on that.
It's easy. Yeah, maybe you're able to work on that. I try and go, thank you. And every time I say it, I go, was that too assertive? Was that too presumptive? Anyway, thank you. For those that don't know you very well, you are an incredible person. I always have to thank you so much for giving me the gift of being able to talk about my own business. I also have to thank you for diving into one of the weirdest workshops that worked out brilliantly, purely because you were there. And I'm just going to say you're welcome to anybody that gets to use your services and work with you because you are a joy to work with.
Thanks so much, Ollie.
Thank you for joining me, sir. Mwah.